some, but I can't find a woman who interests me. I'm in a mess. You can see that, can't you? What do you advise me to do? What would you do in my place? Listen, I don't want to hold you back any longer, but wake me up tomorrow at 1:30, will you? I'll give you something extra if you'll shine my shoes. And listen, if you've got an extra shirt, a clean one, bring it along, will you? Shit. I'm grinding my balls off on that job, and it doesn't even give me a clean shirt. They've got us over here like a bunch of niggers. Ah, well, shit. I'm gonna take a walk. Wash the dirt out of my belly. Don't forget, tomorrow. For 6 months or more, it's been going on, this correspondence with the rich cunt, Irena. Recently, I've been reporting to Carl every day in order to bring the affair to a head. Because as far as Irena is concerned, this thing could go on indefinitely. In the last few days, there's been a perfect avalanche of letters exchanged. The last letter we dispatched was almost 40 pages long and written in three languages. It was a potpourri, the last letter. Tag ends of old novels, slices from the Sunday supplement, reconstructed versions of old letters to Lona and Tanya, garbled transliterations of Rabelais and Petronius. In short, we exhausted ourselves. Finally, Irena decides to come out of her shell. Finally, a letter arrives giving a rendezvous at her hotel. Carl is pissing in his pants. It's one thing to write letters to a woman you don't know. It's another thing entirely to call on her and make love to her. At the last moment, he's quaking so that I almost fear I'll have to substitute for him. When we get out of the taxi in front of her hotel, he's trembling so much that I have to walk him around the block first. He's already had two Pernods, but they haven't made the slightest impression on him. The sight of the hotel itself is enough to crush him. It's a pretentious place, with one of those huge, empty lobbies in which English women sit for hours with a blank look. In order to make sure that he wouldn't run away, I stood by while the porter telephoned to announce him. Irena was there, and she was waiting for him. As he got into the lift, he threw me a last, despairing glance, one of those mute appeals which a dog makes when you put a noose around its neck. Going through the revolving door, I thought of Van Norden. I go back to the hotel and wait for a telephone call. He's only got an hour's time, and he's promised to let me know the results before going to work. I look over the carbons of the letters we sent her. I try to imagine the situation as it actually is, but it's beyond me. Her letters are much better than ours. They're sincere, that's plain. By now they've sized each other up. I wonder if he's still pissing in his pants. The telephone rings. His voice sounds queer, squeaky, as though he were frightened and jubilant at the same time. He asks me to substitute for him at the office.
Tell the bastard anything. Tell him I'm dying.
Listen, Carl, can you tell me... Hello? Are you Henry Miller? It's a woman's voice. It's Irena. She's saying hello to me. Her voice sounds beautiful over the phone. Beautiful. For a moment, I'm in a perfect panic. I don't know what to say to her. I'd like to say, listen, Irena, I think you are beautiful. I think you're wonderful. I'd like to say one true thing to her, no matter how silly it would sound, because now that I hear her voice, everything has changed. But before I can gather my wits, Carl is on the phone again, and he's saying in that queer, squeaky voice,
"She likes you, Joe. I told her all about you."
At the office, I have to hold copy for Van Norden. When it comes time for the break, he pulls me aside. He looks glum and ravaged.
"So he's dying, is he, the little prick? Listen, what's the lowdown on this?"
"I think he went to see his rich cunt," I answer calmly.
"What? You mean he called on her?"
He seems beside himself.
"Listen, where does she live? What's her name?"
I pretend ignorance.
"Listen," he says, "you're a decent guy. Why the hell don't you let me in on this racket?"
In order to appease him, I promise finally that I'll tell him everything as soon as I get the details from Carl. I can hardly wait myself until I see Carl. Around noon the next day, I knock at his door. He's up already and lathering his beard. Can't tell a thing from the expression on his face. Can't even tell whether he's going to tell me the truth. The sun is streaming in through the open window, the birds are chirping, and yet somehow, why it is I don't know, the room seems more barren and poverty-stricken than ever. The floor is slathered with lather, and on the rack there are two dirty towels which are never changed, and somehow Carl isn't changed either. And that puzzles me more than anything.
This morning the whole world ought to be changed, for bad or good, but changed, radically changed. And yet Carl is standing there, lathering his face, and not a single detail is altered.
"Sit down. Sit down there on the bed," he says. "You're going to hear everything, but wait first. Wait a little."
He commences to lather his face again, and then to hone his razor. He even remarks about the water. No hot water again. "Listen, Carl, I'm on tenterhooks. You can torture me afterward if you like, but tell me now, tell me one thing. Was it good or bad?" He turns away from the mirror with brush in hand and gives me a strange smile.
"Wait, I'm going to tell you everything."
"That means it was a failure."
"No," he says, drawing out his words. "It wasn't a failure, and it wasn't a success, either. By the way, did you fix it up for me at the office? What did you tell them?"
I see it's no use trying to pull it out of him. When he gets good and ready, he'll tell me, not before. I lie back on the bed, silent as a clam. He goes on shaving. Suddenly, apropos of nothing at all, he begins to talk. Disconnectedly at first, and then more and more clearly, emphatically, resolutely. It's a struggle to get it out, but he seems determined to relate everything. He acts as if he were getting something off his conscience. He even reminds me of the look he gave me as he was going up the elevator shaft. He dwells on that, lingeringly, as though to imply that everything were contained in that last moment, as though if he had the power to alter things, he would never have put foot outside the elevator. She was in her dressing sack when he called. There was a bucket of champagne on the dresser. The room was rather dark, and her voice was lovely. He gives me all the details about the room, the champagne, how the garçon opened it, the noise it made, the way her dressing sack rustled when she came forward to greet him. He tells me everything but what I want to hear. It was about 8 when he called on her. At 8:30 he was nervous, thinking about the job.
"It was about 9 when I called you, wasn't it?"
he says. "Yes, about that."
"I was nervous, see?"
"I know that. Go on." I don't know whether to believe him or not, especially after those letters we concocted. I don't even know whether I've heard him accurately, because what he's telling me sounds utterly fantastic, and yet it sounds true, too, knowing the sort of guy he is. And then I remember his voice over the telephone, that strange mixture of fright and jubilation. But why isn't he more jubilant now? He keeps smiling all the time, smiling like a rosy little bedbug that has had its fill.
"It was 9 o'clock, he says once again, "when I called you up, wasn't it?"
I nod my head, wearily. "Yes, it was 9 o'clock. He is certain now that it was 9 o'clock, because he remembers having taken out his watch. Anyway, when he looked at his watch again, it was 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, she was lying on the divan with her boobies in her hands. That's the way he gives it to me, in driblets. At 11 o'clock, it was all settled. They were going to run away, to Borneo. Fuck the husband. She never loved him anyway. She would never have written the first letter if the husband wasn't old and passionless.
And then she says to me, "But listen, dear, how do you know you won't get tired of me?"
At this, I burst out laughing. This sounds preposterous to me. I can't help it. "And you said?"
"What did you expect me to say?" I said, "How could anyone ever grow tired of you?"
And then he describes to me what happened after that. How he bent down and kissed her breasts, and how, after he had kissed them fervidly, he stuffed them back into her corsage, or whatever it is they call these things. And after that, another coupe of champagne. Around midnight, the garçon arrives with beer and sandwiches, caviar sandwiches, and all the while, so he says, he has been dying to take a leak. He had one hard-on, but it faded out. All the while his bladder is fit to burst, but he imagines, the cute little prick that he is, that the situation calls for delicacy. At 1:30, she's for hiring a carriage and driving through the Bois. He has only one thought in his head, how to take a leak.
"I love you. I adore you," he says. "I'll go anywhere you say. Istanbul, Singapore, Honolulu. Only I must go now. It's getting late."
He tells me all this in his dirty little room, with the sun pouring in and the birds chirping away like mad. I don't yet know whether she was beautiful or not. He doesn't know himself, the imbecile. He rather thinks she wasn't. The room was dark, and then there was the champagne, and his nerves all frazzled. "But you ought to know something about her, if this isn't all a goddamned lie."
"Wait a minute," he says.
Wait, let me think. No, she wasn't beautiful. I'm sure of that now. She had a streak of gray hair over her forehead, I remember that. But that wouldn't be so bad. I had almost forgotten it, you see. No, it was her arms. They were thin. They were thin and brittle. He begins to pace back and forth. Suddenly he stops dead. If she were only 10 years younger, he exclaims. If she were 10 years younger, I might overlook the streak of gray hair and even the brittle arms, but she's too old. You see, with a cunt like that, every year counts now. She won't be just 1 year older. Next year, she'll be 10 years older. Another year hence, and she'll be 20 years older, and I'll be getting younger looking all the time, at least for another 5 years.
But how did it end? I interrupt.
That's just it. It didn't end. I promised to see her Tuesday, around 5 o'clock. That's bad, you know? There were lines in her face, which will look much worse in daylight. I suppose she wants me to fuck her Tuesday. Fucking in the daytime. You don't do it with a cunt like that, especially in a hotel like that. I'd rather do it on my night off, but Tuesday's not my night off, and that's not all. I promised her a letter in the meantime. How am I going to write her a letter now? I haven't anything to say. Shit! If only she were 10 years younger. Do you think I should go with her? To Borneo, or wherever it is she wants to take me? What would I do with a rich cunt like that on my hands? I don't know how to shoot. I am afraid of guns and all that sort of thing. Besides, she'll be wanting me to fuck her night and day. Nothing but hunting and fucking all the time. I can't do it!
Maybe it won't be so bad as you think. She'll buy you ties and all sorts of things.
Maybe you'll come along with us, eh? I told her all about you.
Did you tell her I was poor? Did you tell her I needed things?
I told her everything. Shit, everything would be fine if she were just a few years younger. She said she was turning 40. That means 50 or 60. It's like fucking your own mother. You can't do it. It's impossible.
But she must have had some attractiveness. You were kissing her breasts, you said.
Kissing her breasts? What's that? Besides, it was dark, I'm telling you.
Putting on his pants, a button falls off.
Look at that, will you? It's falling apart, the goddamn suit. I've worn it for 7 years now. I never paid for it either. It was a good suit once, but it stinks now. And that cunt would buy me suits too, all I wanted most likely. But that's what I don't like, having a woman shell out for me. I never did that in my life. That's your idea. I'd rather live alone. Shit, this is a good room, isn't it? What's wrong with it? It's a damn sight better than her room, isn't it? I don't like her fine hotel. I'm against hotels like that. I told her so. She said she didn't care where she lived. Said she'd come and live with me if I wanted her to. Can you picture her moving in here with her big trunks and her hat boxes and all that crap she drags around with her? She has too many things. Too many dresses and bottles and all that. It's like a clinic, her room. If she gets a little scratch on her finger, it's serious. Then she has to be massaged and her hair has to be waved and she mustn't eat this and she mustn't eat that. Listen, Joe, she'd be all right if she were just a little younger. You can forgive a young cunt anything. A young cunt doesn't have to have any brains. They're better without brains. But an old cunt, even if she's brilliant, even if she's the most charming woman in the world, nothing makes any difference. A young cunt is an investment. An old cunt is a dead loss. All they can do for you is buy you things, but that doesn't put meat on their arms or juice between their legs. She isn't bad, Irena. In fact, I think you'd like her. With you, it's different. You don't have to fuck her. You can afford to like her. Maybe you wouldn't like all those dresses and the bottles and whatnot, but you could be tolerant. She wouldn't bore you. That I can tell you. She's even interesting, I might say, but she's withered. Her breasts are all right yet, but her arms. I told her I'd bring you around someday. I talked a lot about you. I didn't know what to say to her. Maybe you'd like her, especially when she's dressed. I don't know.
Listen, she's rich, you say. I like her. I don't care how old she is, so long as she's not a hag.
She's not a hag. What are you talking about? She's charming, I tell you. She talks well. She looks well, too. Only her arms.
All right, if that's how it is, I'll fuck her. If you don't want to. Tell her that. Be subtle about it, though. With a woman like that, you've got to do things slowly. You bring me around and let things work out for themselves. Praise the shit out of me. Act jealous-like. Shit, maybe we'll fuck her together. And we'll go places and we'll eat together and we'll drive and hunt and wear nice things. If she wants to go to Borneo, let her take us along. I don't know how to shoot either, but that doesn't matter. She doesn't care about that either. She just wants to be fucked, that's all. You're talking about her arms all the time. You don't have to look at her arms all the time, do you? Look at this bedspread. Look at the mirror. Do you call this living? Do you want to go on being delicate and live like a louse all your life? You can't even pay your hotel bill, and you've got a job, too.
This is no way to live. I don't care if she's 70 years old. It's better than this.
Listen, Joe, you fuck her for me. Then everything will be fine. Maybe I'll fuck her once in a while, too, on my night off. It's 4 days now since I've had a good shit. There's something sticking to me like grapes.
You've got the piles, that's what.
My hair's falling out, too, and I ought to see the dentist. I feel as though I were falling apart. I told her what a good guy you are. You'll do things for me, eh? You're not too delicate, eh? If we go to Borneo, I won't have hemorrhoids anymore. Maybe I'll develop something else, something worse. Fever, perhaps, or cholera. Shit! It's better to die of a good disease like that than to piss your life away on a newspaper with grapes up your ass and buttons falling off your pants. I'd like to be rich. Even if it were only for a week. And then go to a hospital with a good disease, a fatal one, and have flowers in the room, and nurses dancing around, and telegrams coming. They take good care of you if you're rich. They wash you with cotton batting, and they comb your hair for you. Shit, I know all that. Maybe I'd be lucky and not die at all. Maybe I'd be a cripple all my life. Maybe I'd be paralyzed and have to sit in a wheelchair, but then I'd be taken care of just the same. Even if I had no more money. If you're an invalid, a real one, they don't let you starve. And you get a clean bed to lie in. And they change the towels every day. This way, nobody gives a fuck about you, especially if you have a job. They think a man should be happy if he's got a job. What would you rather do, be a cripple all your life or have a job, or marry a rich cunt? You'd rather marry a rich cunt, I can see that. You only think about food. But supposing you married her and then you couldn't get a hard-on anymore. That happens sometimes. What would you do then? You'd be at her mercy. You'd have to eat out of her hand like a little poodle dog. You'd like that, would you? Or maybe you don't think of those things. I think of everything. I think of the suits I'd pick out and the places I'd like to go to, but I also think of the other thing. That's the important thing. What good are the fancy ties and the fine suits if you can't get a hard-on anymore? You couldn't even betray her, because she'd be on your heels all the time. No, the best thing would be to marry her and then get a disease right away. Only not syphilis, cholera, let's say, or yellow fever, so that if a miracle did happen and your life was spared, you'd be a cripple for the rest of your days. Then you wouldn't have to worry about fucking her anymore, and you wouldn't have to worry about the rent either. She'd probably buy you a fine wheelchair with rubber tires and all sorts of levers and whatnot. You might even be able to use your hands. I mean, enough to be able to write. Or you could have a secretary, for that matter. That's it. That's the best solution for a writer. What does a guy want with his arms and legs? He doesn't need arms and legs to write with. He needs security, peace, protection. All those heroes who parade in wheelchairs, it's too bad they're not writers. If you could only be sure when you go to war that you'd have only your legs blown off. If you could be sure of that, I'd say let's have a war tomorrow. I wouldn't give a fuck about the medals. They could keep the medals. All I'd want is a good wheelchair and 3 meals a day. Then I'd give them something to read, those pricks.
The following day at 1:30, I call on Van Norden. It's his day off, or rather his night off. He has left word with Carl that I am to help him move today. I find him in a state of unusual depression. He hasn't slept a wink all night, he tells me. There's something on his mind, something that's eating him up. It isn't long before I discover what it is. He's been waiting impatiently for me to arrive in order to spill it. That guy, he begins, meaning Carl. That guy's an artist. He described every detail minutely. He told it to me with such accuracy that I know it's all a goddamn lie. But I can't dismiss it from my mind. You know how my mind works. He interrupts himself to inquire if Carl has told me the whole story. There isn't the least suspicion in his mind that Carl may have told me one thing and him another. He seems to think that the story was invented expressly to torture him. He doesn't seem to mind so much that it's a fabrication. It's the images, as he says, which Carl left in his mind that get him. The images are real, even if the whole story is false. And besides, the fact that there actually is a rich cunt on the scene and that Carl actually paid her a visit, that's undeniable. What actually happened is secondary. He takes it for granted that Carl put the boots to her. But what drives him desperate is the thought that what Carl has described to him might have been possible. It's just like that guy, he says, to tell me he put it to her 6 or 7 times. I know that's a lot of shit, and I don't mind that so much, but when he tells me that she hired a carriage and drove him out to the bois and that they used the husband's fur coat for a blanket, that's too much.
I suppose he told you about the chauffeur waiting respectfully. And listen, did he tell you how